advisement. All right, we're going to go on to 083109, United States versus Danny Turner. Good morning, Mr. Santhanam.
May it please the court. My name is Hari Santhanam on behalf of Danny Turner, the defendant appellant. The Confrontation Clause issue in this case may be decided based on the answers to two questions. One, did the government's expert, Mr. Robert Block, convey testimonial hearsay, in which case there was error? And two, if so, did the government meet its burden of proving that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? On the first question, we know there was error in this case because there are at least two bases in the record. First, Mr. Block affirmatively referenced Amanda Hansen's The Absent Chemist's conclusions. And two,
let me ask one thing. Mr. Block, I mean, the chemist had testified. That's Mr. Block, wasn't it?
That's right.
Didn't he review the tests that were performed by, was it Ms. Hansen, review the test and gave his own independent opinion that the material that was tested was cocaine, using the gas chromometer and there's another test too. But, I mean, he didn't just parrot the opinion of the chemist. He, in fact, went and determined that he would arrive at the same opinion looking at the same materials. Isn't that correct?
Well, Judge Van Bocklin, I don't think that's the entire story here. Mr. Block's testimony did give some analysis of Hansen's results, but
it was more than some analysis. I mean, except for the one, arguably the vouching part of it, that, you know, I agreed with Mrs. Hansen, taking that to the side right now, and that was a very short remark. It didn't take up a whole lot of time in the trial, maybe 5 seconds. Except for that, as I read the transcript, he made an independent determination based on the results of the test which Ms. Hansen had run, that it was in fact, crack cocaine. Am I correct?
He did, in fact, provide his analysis, Your Honor, but the problem is that he testified without personal knowledge to the factual predicate underlying Hansen's results. That's really the issue here. To phrase it rather crassly, it's a garbage-in, garbage-out problem. He testified to his analysis of Hansen's results, her handwritten notes, and her laboratory report, but we don't know what happened in the laboratory. From the point that the evidence came into the lab to the point that the evidence was placed in the machines that generated the data in this case, we don't know what happened. And the reason is because the government didn't provide anybody with personal knowledge that could testify to that.
Isn't it somewhat similar to the situation in Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the Moon case?
We don't believe that is the case because in that case, in Moon, the defendant specifically waived those issues. They abandoned the issues of chain of custody. They abandoned the issue of authentication of the test results. Rather, what they contested was what came out of the machines, the data, the raw data, and whether or not the expert in that case could testify based on that data. They didn't contest what went into the machine. Rather, here we do contest that.
But at this case, I'm spending way too much time, and I'm going to stop at this point. But at the time the question was asked, what is your opinion, there was no objection imposed at that point, was there?
At that point, there were a number of objections prior to that, Judge.
But they weren't asked to the competency of the witness to give an opinion as to whether or not this was a controlled substance. That wasn't no objection was ever imposed as to that issue.
We don't believe that was even the question, Your Honor. In fact, it was just the question posed was, how do you know what happened in the lab? And Mr. Block went on to testify as to all of the standard operating procedure of the lab, and then he went on to testify, independent of the question, that he and Hansen reached the same conclusions. And I would have to disagree very strongly, Judge Van Bocklin, that this is something that we can dismiss as a fleeting comment. In fact, the government in this case introduced not just one opinion, but two separate opinions, one each by two separate experts.
It might have been error, but there was no objection, as Judge Van out. And why would that not be harmless?
Well, to address the first part, that there was no objection, we believe that there was no need to make a further objection because Mr. Turner properly preserved his objection by presenting his motion in limine. And when the court overruled that motion, it wasn't a conditional ruling. There was no suggestion in the record that it was based on some sort of condition. It was an outright overruling.
But isn't Carter's a motion in limine generally a preliminary ruling? I mean, it's a pretrial ruling before the evidence has, in fact, been offered.
Generally, that might be the case, but I don't believe that we can apply that reasoning in this case for two reasons. One, if we look to Rule 103A of the Federal Rules of Evidence, it suggests that if the district court makes a definitive ruling on the record, then there's no need to make a further objection. And this court has recognized that. For example, in the Witt versus Kowalski case cited in the reply, this court has expressly recognized that once a motion in limine has been definitively ruled upon, there's no reason to renew that objection or make a motion to strike the testimony at trial. And that's exactly what happened here. There's no question that the error was preserved, and I don't think the government contests that. Rather, what we have here is, as I was explaining, is that we have two separate opinions by two separate experts, one of whom was not subject to cross-examination. And Judge Rovner, as you noted, that the issue here isn't whether or not there was error. The issue is whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And we submit that it is not. For example, using the Fourth Circuit's reasoning in United States versus Kung, spelled C-O-U-N-G, the Fourth Circuit noted that Mr. Block, at the very least, improperly bolstered his own conclusions by stating that this separate expert came to the same conclusions based on the same set of results. The only inference we can draw from that is that his conclusion was bolstered.
Of course, in the other case, he vouched for a doctor in the case you cited, and says, good friend of mine, and I think he's wonderful. No, I mean, there's a little more vouching going on in that case than went on in this case.
I'd have to disagree with that. In the Kung case that the Fourth Circuit decided, the key issues were, or the key facts were, that the expert that testified for the government built up the resume of the second expert, and he testified what his conclusions were, that they both reached the same conclusions. That same circumstance exists here. Mr. Block testified to exactly the type of experience that the analysts at the lab have, what type of training that they undergo, and he went on to say that the two of them came to the same conclusions. And the Fourth Circuit found that a nearly identical statement was grounds for reversible error. And so I don't think we can dismiss the statement as some sort of fleeting comment. There was error, and it presents a reasonable possibility of having contributed to Turner's conviction. If I may turn to the other aspect, that Mr. Block's testimony itself, that this is the second basis for error, that Mr. Block's testimony itself was based on Hansen's testimonial hearsay.
Let me ask you this. A case like this where there's, I think, maybe I'm wrong, you tell me, but there was no defense that's offered. The government's case includes an undercover who's deals with crack cocaine, testifies about three transactions buying crack, with he thinks is crack, from Turner. Why do you even need an expert witness in a case?
The reason being is if we apply the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, we don't believe that sort of information is cumulative. It's the fact that Mr. Block based his testimony on testimonial hearsay, that was error, and we don't believe that it was cumulative.
Well, I understand that if you had a case where the defense was going to be, hey, I was ripping this guy off, I'm selling baking soda and not crack cocaine. But with absent that, here I have the testimony that the jury hears of someone who is undercover buying, saying, do you have any crack to sell? Yes. How much? And you're doing the dealing back and forth. Why do you even need an expert in a case like that?
Well, the reason we need an expert is that the government argued that this isn't fake crack cocaine, that this is the real stuff. This comes right out of their closing argument. They tried to convince the jury exactly what this was, that we were introducing an exhibit, we're identifying it as crack cocaine. And the issue here is, you know, what the impact on the jury was. And they presented all this testimony by an expert who had no personal knowledge. And that's really the issue. What happened when the evidence came into the lab and when it was put, and until when the evidence was put in the machines. What happened beyond that really isn't the issue.
Don't you see situations, though, when experts testify, especially if they have people working for them, that they will rely on information they receive from the people working directly under them in order to arrive at their opinion, ultimate opinion?
That's absolutely correct. But the confrontation clause problem arises is when the factual predicate itself is testimonial. In a lot of circumstances, I see that my time is out.
No, you may, of course, finish your thought.
In a lot of circumstances, the underlying information itself isn't testimonial. For example, this court recognized in United States versus Ellis, in that case, the experimentation, the tests, they were conducted at a hospital. And so the underlying information itself wasn't testimonial. And so when the expert got up on the stand and testified, that wasn't an issue under the confrontation clause. Here, I think by statute, we know that everything produced at the Wisconsin State Crime Lab, all of that work product, is testimonial because by statute it is for the assistance of in the prosecution of a crime. And I ask that this court reverse the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Reinhart.
Good afternoon. David Reinhart for the United States. It's our position that this case squarely falls under this circuit's prior decision in United States versus Moon.
Well, our decision in Moon suggests that if Mr. Turner wanted Ms. Hansen to testify so that he could question her as to the procedure she followed, and he was entitled under the conference to have that opportunity. So even if it was permissible for Mr. Block to testify, wasn't Mr. Turner also entitled to the chance to examine Ms. Hansen, given that she's the only person with personal knowledge as to the procedure she followed?
If it was a testimonial statement, here we relied on the raw data, and as set forth in Moon, raw data generated from a lab machine is not a statement subject to the confrontation clause, and I think that's the difference. It would be one thing if we were bringing in a testimonial statement.
Well, I mean, he's saying, I reached the same conclusion that she did. In other words, he's essentially telling the jury what Hansen had concluded as well as what he had concluded.
I agree with the court on that, that in fact he did blurt out that he had reached the same conclusion as the examining expert, but and that under this court's precedent would seem to violate the confrontation clause. However, I believe that is harmless based on Moon. Moon had almost actually a more egregious situation in which the actual lab report was entered into evidence, and then there was another, and then the expert also made an independent conclusion that it was cocaine-based, and in Moon, they said that was not did not taint that independent conclusion. So I think Moon actually addressed your concerns.
I understand that the chemist who actually ran the test that had a baby the day before the trial, was there any reason that Garmuth, however, notwithstanding that, did not move for a would not have been better if Mrs. Hansen had testified? Would you agree with that?
Oh, we probably wouldn't be here today, true.
And I'm not trying to second-guess anybody, but is there any reason, really, why there wasn't a motion for continuance by the government to set the trial at a time that Ms. Hansen would have been available to testify?
We did not. I mean, we considered that. However, in our district, especially with criminal cases, a lot of times those sort of continuances are not granted, so we decided just to go ahead based on our reading of Moon. And after reading Moon, we thought that we were on solid footing to go ahead and prosecute the case. As far as the lab notes, I know in the brief they talked quite a bit about the lab notes. The lab notes themselves aren't testimonial, and they're not coming to any sort of conclusion. The conclusion as to whether a substance is a controlled substance or cocaine-based is based on the tests that are performed in the lab. And in any event, the lab notes were never introduced into evidence. The lab notes, the contents of them were never, there's never any testimony regarding the contents of those particular lab notes. And I think we're getting pretty far afield when we're trying to say that lab notes are now testimonial statements, from those original examples that we had in Crawford, the affidavits that were that are submitted or the grand jury testimony or preliminary hearing testimony. I think lab notes, although not in the record, lab notes really do document the exhibits that are being examined and what tests were actually run by that particular analyst. As far as the chain of custody, I think it's well settled that you don't need a perfect chain of custody. It goes to weight and not admissibility. Here, they had the opportunity to cross-examine a witness on the stand regarding the chain of custody, and they did. And they had the opportunity to argue that to the jury, which they didn't. I don't think that was ultimately the issue in this particular case. And as this court has stated, merely raising a possibility of tampering or something going wrong at the lab without any support is not enough. And there was also nothing wrong about Mr. Block's testimony in establishing the chain of custody regarding the procedures used at the crime lab when these exhibits come in. Specifically, Federal Rule of Evidence 901B9 endorses that sort of method as a proper method of authentication. Therefore, in conclusion, the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting those exhibits. And if the court doesn't have any further questions,
yes, question. Would you agree, though, that Block's reference to his results were the same as Ms. Hansen's? That was improper.
That's correct. And we believe that based on Moon, that is harmless.
Thank you. You used all your time up, but I will give you an extra minute.
A few things I would like to bring to the court's attention was that the Supreme Court is deciding Melendez-Diaz, Massachusetts versus Melendez-Diaz, and we were initially optimistic that the court would come down with an opinion prior to today. As of this morning, they have not, and so it may be appropriate, as all of the briefs indicate, to hold the opinion in that case until Melendez-Diaz has been decided. The second thing I'd like to discuss is that the government tries to indicate that because a lab report was admitted in Moon, that the circumstances in this case are not as harmful, that it is harmless. And I don't think we can extend the analysis in Moon to this case for two reasons. And quickly, that one is that Moon was decided under the stringent plain error standard. And two, that in Moon, it was found to be harmless because the expert's testimony in that case was independently permissible under the Confrontation Clause. That's not the case here. The error in this case isn't simply that Mr. Block referenced Hansen's conclusions, but all of his conclusions were based on her testimonial hearsay. And so because it wasn't independently consistent with the Confrontation Clause, we believe that the Moon is inapplicable. Thank you.
Mr. Santini, you were court appointed, were you not?
Yes, I was.
You certainly have, as does your law firm of Kirkland and Ellis, profound thanks of this court for taking this job and doing such a fine job. As always, we thank. Thank you. The court is now in recess, and we can all go to the country.